This podcast is brought to you by the Association for Child and Adolescent Mental Health, ACAM for short. You can find more podcasts and other resources on our website, www.acamh.org, and follow us on social media by searching ACAMH.
So hello, I'm Dr. Seanet Janderson. I'm a research psychologist and a neurodiversity consultant with an interest in tics and tic disorders like Tourette syndrome. I'm really excited to be here today as this is part of our series of podcasts that ACAM is hosting on Tourette syndrome. And over the course of the series, we've been looking at the latest evidence-based research and how to support young people in school, as well as discussing some of the treatments. And today I'm speaking with Dr. Tammy Hedderly, who is a consultant pediatric neurologist who works in the Tics and Neurodevelopmental Movement Service, or TANDEM, at St. Thomas's Hospital in London. The title of our discussion is Tics and Tic Disorders, Sudden Onset and Influences of the Pandemic. Can you start by describing a bit about the clinic where you work and what it offers and what kind of patients that you see?
I work with a team. So a few years ago now, we recognised the importance of children with movement difficulties having access to a number of professionals that could look at the difficulties the child was having from several angles, including from their psychological angle, because some of the children we see, for example, children with Tourette syndrome, do have psychological problems together with their movement difficulties. So we know, for example, that tics can come together with OC behaviours, obsessive compulsive behaviours. So I wrote a grant to develop a service in which we could employ a psychologist working alongside the neurologist and also a psychiatrist assigned to the clinic. And then with time, we expanded. We're very fortunate now. We've got two nurses. We've got two psychologists. So we do see lots of children with movement difficulties. We tend to prioritise children who have difficulties that can respond to psychological treatments as well. So that, say, for example, dystonias with complex motor syndrome, where the children might need complicated medical care, we've differentiated a little bit away from that service. So we've got two services at Evelina, mainly dealing with movement, complex motor sort of service, and then the Tourette's and neurodevelopmental movement service. Well, we've been going for many years. We have a great team and we do multidisciplinary assessments. We do, unfortunately, have a long waiting list because the first appointment is quite long and detailed. And we include in that assessment of the common comorbidities and co-occurring conditions that go alongside movement. We do not just tics, we do movements like stereotypies. We see children with functional movement conditions. And we see paroxysmal movement conditions like paroxysmal dyskinesias, which are quite rare.
It's a tier four service. So what kind of journey will the patients have had before they sort of come to see you?
Ideally, as a clinician, you want to be able to help anybody that's referred to you. So traditionally, I always accepted all referrals, including general practitioner referrals, which often are the early referrals and provide the best support for families because they get straight into the service, they get a rapid assessment. Of course, with time, the referral numbers increased. And so we are under pressure because it's an NHS service to provide regional services. So I work at South Thames Hospital, Evelina, London Children's Hospital. And so we take from the South Thames area, and you know that we've got Tourette and tic and movement services north of the river at Great Ormond Street, over at St George's as well. There's some services in Nottingham and over in the UK, probably four or five Tourette services. So we are under pressure not to take from out of region. We've also got pressure not to take now GP referrals direct. We're supposed to take from paediatricians and from CAM services. The reality, though, as you know, is that it's very hard to get into those services because of the stretch. There's a lot of people being referred. There's also limited services. We have flexed our pathways somewhat over a few years. And the most important thing I would say to that question is that we should be striving to form more networks and more liaison and discussions and support, working locally where possible and then a hub and spoke type model where clinicians have access to advice if they need it from a tertiary and quaternary service. It's not a straightforward answer because at the end of the day, there's patients and families who need help. And I was having this discussion very recently, trying to suggest, I mean, I don't want to get into politics, but at the end of the day, I think we have to stay focused on what we can do and then try and work towards how we provide it. And when you are informed that there's fines, for example, if you have long wait lists, that's not a concern for the families. What they want is a service that can respond and provide clinical care for their often quite desperate need because they haven't been able to find anyone to support them.
I know that from parents, they've really felt there's such a patchy service across the UK and in some areas that there doesn't seem to be a clinical pathway for tics and Tourette syndrome. And my colleague, Bethan Davies, and I made an animation recently just to try and highlight some of that complexity that you're talking about. And sometimes patients end up being sort of bounced backwards and forwards between professionals as well. I wonder, do you think something like NICE guidelines for tics and tic disorders would be a step forward in terms of solving some of those issues?
Even with our own little service, we've tried to create pathways to referral. And it is a complex area because you know what the ideal pathway would look like. And then there are often so many barriers because we all rely on the provision of services and the availability. Even though I work in an incredibly supportive organisation, I see someone, we make a plan, but then there's no one at the end of that plan to deliver the care, either locally where the child ideally needs it, or even within our own services because of redeployment. I mean, obviously COVID hasn't helped with redeployment and sickness and changing circumstances, people wanting to live and be at home with their children. So there's lots of reasons why the services have been stretched. I think it's worse than it has been for a long time in terms of access to services. And as you know, it's always been a problem. And then we've also now seen this escalation in children presenting, which is unprecedented. And I am concerned of how the services are going to cope with that demand. Mm-hmm. Might need to think creatively about other ways to provide support and care than through our traditional clinic model.
Just to give a quick introduction for those people that are listening as to what tics, tic disorders and Tourette syndrome are, is it possible to just give sort of a quick overview of those characteristics?
If we're looking at tics, we define tics, there are two types. There's either movements or sounds, so usually called motor or phonic tics, sometimes vocal instead of phonic. These are quite typical movements that are often suggestible, very brief. They involve different body parts. Traditionally in tic disorders, the tics start around the ages of 4 to 6. They start usually around the eyes, blinking around the face and the head, and then often spread down to involve other parts of the body over time. They have features like waxing and waning, so there'll be patches where the tics are more obvious than at other times, and quieter periods. Tics are associated from about the age of 8 onwards or 9 with a premonitory urge, and that this is where the children or young people report a build-up of inner sensations, tension or tummy-ache or headache or pressing feeling that's then released when the movement or sound occurs. They're somewhat suppressible in some children and young people. It's the suggestible nature, the ability to suppress, the presence of a premonitory urge, and then the characteristic features, which are interesting. I usually say to my patients, tics won't injure the brain because the movements and sounds are all things that we would sometimes do anyway. So you might rub your nose or blink your eyes, but they're happening in an unusual place at an unusual time. And their movements and sounds aren't being regulated and inhibited by the brain, so they release. And this is helpful because I think it reassures lots of people that actually, if you can do those movements and sounds, that's why they're not particularly damaging, although, of course, they can be very annoying and uncomfortable. That's an interesting characteristic because this is one of the things we're seeing that's quite different at the moment, in that up until recently, many children experiencing tics really don't want them and they don't like them. They want them to go away. And some of the novel presentations we're seeing at the moment, there's a certain, in some children, there's almost a certain release of enjoyment and relaxation about the tics, and some young people are almost laughing about the tics and enjoying them, and that's an interesting phenomenon that we haven't come across, we don't quite understand at the moment. It's an interesting characteristic and something we need to keep an open mind about.
And tics in general, I mean, would you say that tics are probably more common than we think? If we just think, you know, there can be childhood tics that may not reach a diagnosis of a tic disorder, but actually they can be quite common?
Yes, I think tics can be very common, and certainly around that age in early childhood, they're considered a developmental phenomenon, and it's not uncommon to have a few tics that wax and wane and children grow out of, and may not have even been noticed by the child or by the parent. I think when the tics become more impairing or the child starts to report annoyance, we're moving towards probably a rarer phenomenon. I mean, we know that the figures for prevalence of Tourette syndrome in childhood is probably around 1%. I mean, that's 1 in 100. It's quite common. But I think we know that lots of people don't seek a diagnosis, and that's in the population where the diagnosis is made. So it's going to be higher than that.
And I think that's sometimes quite a surprise when you talk to people that maybe don't know so much about tics, that actually the prevalence is at 1% for Tourette syndrome, and they might be quite surprised at that. Also with this media representation that it involves swearing, and we know actually through research that it's just around about 10 to 15% of the people that have the coprolalia, have the swearing tic as well. There seems to be sort of almost three groups or three kinds of issues happening, where maybe people who have tics and tic disorders already are experiencing a real increase in the intensity and frequency of tics since the sort of pandemic started. And then there's another group of people who may have had very mild tics because of the situation of the pandemic, then this has led them to perhaps meet a threshold where they would in fact meet a diagnosis for a tic disorder. And then there's another group of adolescent females you discussed in your recent paper, where it seems almost like a complete and sudden onset in these adolescents. Is that a fair summation of what's been happening during the pandemic?
I think there's probably a little bit more crossover within those groups. But the more children we're seeing, it's not quite as clear cut as, you know, being able to characterise children in this way. And I think there is another group where their children are reporting that their tics are actually much calmer. These are the young people who are known to us in clinic already, who aren't presenting during COVID lockdown. But when we're asking them how things are, they're saying actually things have been much better without maybe the pressure of having to get up and go to school, being a bit more relaxed, being spending more time at home. So I think we must be careful, as we always have to be in any sort of observation, that it's not referral bias. We're not focusing on it because it's in our current clinic. So I'm trying to reflect and think about all the young people who are doing quite well, that we keep that open mind and explore why people are so much better.
These sort of sudden and new onset cases of tic-like behaviour, can you tell us a bit more about that? You wrote a recent paper sort of suggesting that pandemic stressors, as we could call them, such as loss of social supports and academic challenges of distance learning, etc., and sort of emotional distress to do with the restrictions. Do you think that's at the heart of what's happening? Why are these adolescent females coming forward with this sort of florid onset?
This is very complicated. The answer I'm going to give you, you know, I'm going to tell you, we really, really don't know at the moment. I think we need to research what is happening and really be careful, together with clinicians and researchers and academics across the world, to try and understand this phenomenon. It is, personally for me, I found it quite challenging because of the increased workload, but I'm at the same time feeling in a desperate need to help people. This is coming with quite marked distress. The families are often beside themselves and haven't really got any tools because this is such sudden onset. There are some hypotheses I've, you know, thought about and discussed with colleagues. We are seeing a group of young girls who are telling us from their own stories that they're using social media, certain websites, and viewing certain characters who have become very, very famous. So this is a hypothesis at the moment. And I don't think that this is going to be as simple as something like mimicry or suggestibility directly, because the families that we're seeing where this is happening, where the young girls are presenting with florid onset sudden Tourette's on a background of very few tics, if any, often come from families where there might be a first degree relative with Tourette, which is very interesting, or there may be a sibling with ADHD or a diagnosis of autism spectrum, or a family member with autism spectrum and or even mild neurodevelopmental difficulties that haven't reached diagnostic cutoff. So we have started collecting, with the family's permission, lots of data around these issues, whether there's some neurodevelopmental vulnerabilities in the young girls, and then combined with other factors like an exposure to charismatic characters on social media, there's somehow suggestibility. We need to talk to the social cognitive scientists and the psychologists about this in more detail to try and understand that, as well as the researchers on similar kind of things that have happened in the past where there's been a sudden increase in movement difficulties. We need to think about the functional story, because some of the tics have a functional type characteristic and have a slightly different characteristic to Tourette-related tics, although I'm also quite cautious about sometimes differentiating the two, because the management of functional tics versus Tourette-related tics is, and sometimes you have the two, often you have the two actually in the same person, the management techniques are very similar, like distractive attention training, focus, non-suggestibility, and lots of, we use lots of psychological techniques. I think if you've got functional tics and you're dealing with a clinic where you're going to use lots of medication, this is quite important to differentiate the two, because we find that often they don't respond to medication in the same way as some of the more typical Tourette-related tics. So a lot to talk about, a lot of work to be done. I can tell you we're in discussions with our colleagues from around the world and our European Tourette's Society colleagues who are seeing very similar patterns. And I think that I don't want to be just focused on social media, but I was very concerned to see that some of the young people on the social media have millions of views. And if you look at hashtag Tourette on one particular website, there's 3.4 billion views, which I was astonished by. And I think we have a lot to learn from the people who are presenting. One of the biggest challenges we have at the moment is, what do we call this? By definition, I didn't mention that, but obviously it's arbitrary when we say the definition of Tourette's, it's created by a group of people. And we say the tics have gone on, wax and wane, for more than a year. And that was thought up many years ago as part of the definition of Tourette's, because there's so many people who have a few periods of waxing, waning tics. And people said, well, we can't have so many people with Tourette's. But you can see it's not really science-based. It's not taking into account the neurobiology of tics. It's just people saying, well, if the tics have happened for a year, we should call it Tourette's. And if it's under a year, we shouldn't. So when the girls are saying, well, have I got Tourette's? Well, strictly speaking, if they haven't had tics before this sudden onset, they can't be called Tourette's, which is, you know, sometimes challenging, because it may have been that the girls have identified as having Tourette's, and we don't know yet what's going to happen. We're hoping that the tics are going to go away as quickly as they came.
I mean, in the past, I understand what you're saying about that. In order to achieve a diagnosis of Tourette syndrome, the tics have to sort of be around for about a year. But I mean, would you know? I think there's a lot of stigma also around the phrase or the diagnosis of Tourette syndrome, and maybe in the future it might be called something else. I guess you know, tic spectrum disorder or something like that. Would you in these cases sort of refer to the symptoms a bit more like tic-like behavior?
I think that's a really good question. I don't really like terms like disorder and syndrome, and we both agree that neurodiversity and staying positive and describing personality traits as spectrums are probably preferable, and often the families prefer it. So I do have that discussion with the family directly usually, and I tend to prefer the term Tourette's spectrum. If I write in my letters, unless somebody feels strongly they want to use themselves, the patient wants to use the term Tourette's syndrome, I tend to talk about the Tourette's spectrum. I think when it comes to these new presentations, at the moment I'm calling this tics and tic-like behaviours, tic-like attacks, functional tic-like movements, depending on the individual, because there's a surprising number of the girls who have this florid onset severe presentation, never seen a doctor with tics, but when you go back through the history, may have had some subtle unrecognised tics, which is quite an interesting phenomenon. So they may have been to the hay fever doctor with some sneezing. They may have had some ophthalmology visits, optician visits for eye blinking. And sometimes they have obsessional compulsive type personalities and perfectionist traits. There's some patterns emerging. I don't want to say too much too early because we haven't collected and analysed all the data yet, although that is planned and that is happening.
And I think that's interesting also for other clinicians to hear as well, what kinds of questions they should consider asking about when they're taking a history as well. You at this TIC specialist centre, do you think there's going to be a difference down the line with GPs and CAMHS clinics? How will they be managing this influx? What advice could you give to clinicians?
Well, I mean, I think because of the difficulty getting rapid access to services, the first thing to think about is that the tics and tic-like attacks and functional tics and Tourette's are managed quite similarly with non-suggestibility. All the episodes will get worse with lots of positive attention and reward and massages for tics, hot water bottles. They're all things we advise against during the episodes of tics. Of course, you can have attention, but not during the episode of tics. So by trying simple selective attention, by which I mean moving attention away to having attention around the person when they're not ticking, and if they are having tics, whatever type, trying to practice moving away from that person so that the tics can calm down and non-suggestibility. So there are some generic techniques that work for all of the types of tics. I think that in terms of the questions to ask, personally, I think it's very important to ask the young people what they are accessing about tics, what they're looking at, what media sites are they on? Are they someone who's spending, because of lockdown, a lot of time in their bedroom alone on unsupervised media use? Of course, the teenagers aren't so keen to talk about that necessarily. And I've had situations where the girls have got quite upset with me when I've asked some of the questions about it and actually have said no. And then afterwards, maybe have said, well, actually, I have probably been spending too much time on this particular site. So they are reluctant sometimes to talk about it. So the questioning has to be careful and sensitive. And even parents who tell me they know their child very, very well and are very supervised and they've turned on parental controls, with careful questioning and with time with the psychologist, it's sometimes come to light that there's been a lot more exposure to Tourette-related and tic attack sites. And if we think about the science and mechanisms and neurology of tics, and we think about what we were saying at the beginning of the podcast, that suggestibility and talking about tics can exacerbate tics and make them worse. And then you combine that with a young person who's spending a lot of time alone watching videos or even being in a room with somebody with tics or in an environment, whether it's virtual or real, it wouldn't be surprising to see this big escalation in the presentation. And we know that, don't we, from when we've run groups for young people with tics and we've had people all together, and the young people report that when they see someone else with a particular tic, it makes them generate the same tic, and we don't understand why that is fully. We've got some ideas. It's the neurobiology and neurological generation of mimicking people's actions or tic. It's complex and we don't know why, but I suspect there's all these mechanisms at play. For the GP and the paediatrician and the person with the a a teenager in front of them, sudden onset, they let rise and focused attention away from the attacks and the tics and try to reassure the person sensitively that this is going to pass quickly, distract from it, think about something else, let it calm down, and then reinforce and reward the young person when the episodes aren't happening. And we need to make sure that the episode isn't in itself getting inadvertently rewarded by secondary gain. So, for example, some young people, they're having their tic attacks and the parents send them to their bedrooms to relax because they're tired and they give them their electronics. And, of course, that's very, very rewarding to and quite addictive to a young person's brain. So the attack's going to be inadvertently, probably involuntary and subconsciously be reinforced. So switching things around and saying, let's leave the media downstairs, the screen time, and let's have that when you're not having an attack.
And I think that that kind of sort of psychoeducation for parents can be really perhaps eye-opening. I would imagine as a parent, if you're seeing your child have a tic attack and you're distressed and they're distressed, you know, it's almost a parental instinct to you know, comfort and, like you say, massage and hot water block, but actually to move away so you don't accidentally reinforce what might be happening for them. And I think you're absolutely right in terms of the support groups. I know that having worked at Tourette's Action, that was sometimes a concern of people coming and they didn't want to sort of pick up tics from other people, but they did for a while. And maybe it would just be a few hours or maybe a day. But actually what they got out of coming to the support groups, having met people with Tourette syndrome perhaps for the first time, sort of outweighed any sort of annoying tics that might be around for a little while after. And I think that's the difference. Also, I wonder if that's one of the differences between social interaction on even an online community where there's advice and information exchanged as well, as opposed to a different kind of platform that we've been talking about where there's just like a video and not really much support or advice or signposting to education resources to say, oh, I see, you know, you've got this tick or you feel anxious, then maybe try and look at these resources. That seems to be lacking perhaps on some of those social media platforms.
Yes, that's a really good point. And I agree. And I don't want to be overly negative because some of the children have said to me, I find some platforms very helpful because I don't feel alone with my Tourette's and it helps me with my identity and it helps me access the support. And many of my families, as you know, we work very closely with Tourette Action, find it an incredible support. And so it's that balance, isn't it? Trying to promote the positives from access to screens and time on social media with versus the potential difficulties. And I think there's a lot of work for us all to do to try and tease this apart. And I think we're going to have to involve the young people in helping us work out what the benefits are and what the risks are and asking them to inform and how to have a very powerful young girls getting over 300, 400 million views and likes. This is something that's incredible achievement for them, but we need to therefore harness them and say, how can we therefore get the message out to help the people and support the children as well?
It certainly seems to be a phenomena in its own right. If we're thinking about this group of young adolescent women and their clinical presentation and this new sort of onset, which appears perhaps to be functional in nature, what do you think the long-term prognosis will be for these adolescents that have had this experience of this sudden onset?
I think there's going to be different groups. There's some young people I've seen, because I've been noticing this phenomenon since around October, November 2020. And so already we've seen some children just get rapidly better and return to full health and we're following the children up, but they're really reporting, actually they went away very quickly. So that's great. We know some people it's really, you know, going away as quickly as it came. I think that what we've got to be careful of is what are the vulnerability factors that made that happen? Is this going to change into another condition in the same person? Is something else going to pop up? Is this actually a surface marker, a warning sign of something else, a vulnerability within that young person or family? Then there's the group where we don't know. Is this an exacerbation of a Tourette's? Is this an unmasking of a Tourette's? And is the young person going to have more significant Tourette's than they would have had otherwise if there hadn't been the COVID pandemic? And are girls who may have gone through life with a few subtle tics and not presented, now going to present and now live a life with Tourette's? I don't know. That may be a group. Are there young people who have this explosive onset and then the tics settle and they never have a problem again? Let's hope so. But I think that it's too early to say. And I think we just all have to keep an open mind, be as supportive as we can be, recognise that this is a real issue. We have to listen to the young person, think about what it is that they need support with.
And it sounds like research is going to be vital in terms of, and collecting data is going to be vital in terms of understanding the factors associated with the emergence of this and the continuation or cessation.
I think it's going to involve more than just doctors and researchers and clinical scientists. It's going to need the social and cultural understanding. And like you were saying, the people who understand in-depth social media influence and those sort of factors as well. It needs everybody working together.
Just quickly, as we're sort of drawing to a close, I'm just wondering about the immense pressure that's been on your service. I mean, I think you've had a kind of doubling of referrals in regards to the acute onset. What kind of effect do you think has that had on your service? Do you think there are barriers preventing young people from getting the help that they need?
Within our service, we've had redeployment, we've had sickness, we've had people who have had to be at home because their child's had COVID or been out of school. We've had staff members working very hard. The nurses went to intensive care for a while to help with the adults, as we all did at various points during the pandemic. We lost, for example, our junior doctors to adult care for a while because they were more recently used to working with adults. So some of us covered more of the paediatric services. It's been very challenging and there's been a lot of changes. Although we tried to keep running at full capacity via video consultation where possible. Obviously being in a central London hospital, we were affected by travel and transport and the lockdown in terms of seeing families and children face to face, which I find very difficult. I much prefer to meet a family than have a video consultation. Especially for the first time. I think for follow-up appointments and for some of the therapy, videos work well, actually. And we've all seen a big adaptation to our services and lots of positives from learning to work online. But we have had a backlog and we have had an increase in referrals. So the waiting list times have gone up. We are now back to full staffing levels. We had a few of our clinicians who got quite severe COVID, fortunately, have made a full recovery. I think everybody knows the impact, and from a wider level, everybody within it, in clinical services, but also in the wider population and within their families and friends, know what a terrible time it's been. We are a resilient species, I hope. Many of us are quite resilient, and I think hopefully things will slowly go back to normal, whatever that means. And we'll be working hard to try and see as many families and children as we can. And also, I think looking at more creative ways of working, trying to use more group therapies, maybe using more video consultations, rapid access clinics. I mean, this might change. It might change the way we think about neurodevelopmental conditions.
And that's a positive note to be finishing with. But in your paper, I just want to quickly dart back to your paper. You mentioned that it will be important that functional and mental health aspects are considered in the likely increase in physical presentations associated with long COVID in the coming year. And I was quite interested in that. I'd like you to sort of explain a bit about what you meant and what that might mean.
You know, I wrote the paper jointly with Holland and Isabel from Great Ormond Street, who are psychiatrists. And I think together with the psychologists and the psychiatrists, my own team, Dr. Malik, and our psychology team, we've all been aware of this complex connection between physical presentations and the influence of the brain and psychology on that. And I think you've got a condition here. We know with COVID, you get post-inflammatory effects. And we don't know fully and understand the mechanisms behind some of the mental health difficulties we're seeing with the depression and anxiety. We don't know if these are direct effects of the virus or how much of the effects are direct effects of the virus and how much are psychological effects with the change in routine? I think it's too early to say. I think until we understand more about neurobiology of anxiety and of depression and the role of differences in the immune system and the role of inflammation within the wax and wane of those psychological presentations, we won't understand. But there is a lot of work going on in many labs around the world exploring the link between genetics, neurobiology of inflammation, infection, direct infection versus post-infectious phenomenon within neuropsychiatry and movement disorder generally. I mean, the link between movement disorder, psychology and psychiatry we started with, it's still to be defined, and what we need to do is all work together, hence the setting up of the clinic in the first place. I think there's been an awareness that the link between movement conditions, physical conditions, psychology and psychiatry is there for a long, long time, right back to Charcot and our, you know, historical neurologists who were really neurologists and psychiatrists together. And I think that's where we need to be. We need to be working together, not trying to differentiate and working separately, but working holistically to understand these links.
It's absolutely fascinating talking to you, Tammy, and looking at delving in a little bit to this, the phenomenon basically of what's been happening in terms of tics and tic disorders during the pandemic, and also touching on the influence of social media as well. And I hope it's been helpful for people that have been listening too. You can follow me on Twitter at @ShonichAnderson2, or for more details about Tourette syndrome, you can visit the ACAM website at www.acam.org, and you can follow them on social media by searching for ACAM. And also, I know that the Evelina Tandem Clinic has educational resources on their website about tics and Tourette syndrome as well. So thank you so much for joining me. It's been really fascinating. Thanks, Tammy.
Thank you for your time as well and your work with this group of people.
This podcast was brought to you by the Association for Child and Adolescent Mental Health, ACAM for short.